Welcome to a Citations Needed news brief. I'm Nima Shirazi.
I'm Adam Johnson.
You can follow Citations Needed on Twitter at Citations Pod, Facebook Citations Needed, and become a supporter of our work through patreon.com/Citations Needed Podcast. Our support through Patreon is incredibly appreciated as we are 100% listener funded. We do these news briefs in between our regularly scheduled episodes, and today's news brief, Adam, is going to be on Ukraine. Now, we know there has been so much coverage already about media failures, about rampant propaganda, about double standards. I want to make sure that before we get into this, we don't forget to note the imperialism and the racism and imperialism that has been on full display. Say, senior foreign correspondent for CBS, Charlie DeGatta, saying live from Kyiv that, quote, now with the Russians marching in, it's changed the calculus entirely. Tens of thousands of people have tried to flee the city. There will be many more. People are hiding out in bomb shelters, but this isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan that has seen conflict raging for decades. This is a relatively civilized, relatively European city where you wouldn't expect or hope that that's going to happen. You also heard ITV's Lucy Watson call Ukraine not a developing third world nation, and that it was unthinkable that this would happen in the quote-unquote heart of Europe. Of course, the Holocaust happened in the heart of Europe. And let's not forget, before we move on, Al Jazeera's Peter Dobby saying, quote, what's compelling is that just looking at them, the way they're dressed, these are prosperous middle-class people. These are not obviously refugees trying to get away from areas in the Middle East that are still in a big state of war. They look like any European family that you would live next door to, end quote. So with that as preface, Adam, we are going to tackle a number of other media tropes that we've seen play out.
Others have covered the immediate racist orientation. Some of the people we mentioned have since apologized, but obviously the kind of knee-jerk reaction was that this doesn't happen in civilized Europe.
That's right. Blue-eyed Europeans are unacceptable victims of violence.
Right. So on February 24th, Russia, of course, invaded Ukraine based on what appears to be a very moving target and dubious justifications, appealing to a kind of pre-Soviet Tsarist Russia borders of territorial imperialist Russia, blaming Lenin, I think, for Ukrainian nationhood, among many other reasons. And so this was done in a similar framework of kind of preemptive war. Now Russia is attempting to kind of retcon, or at least half-assedly retcon, in some biological or chemical weapon justification, which seems, again, equally dubious. So here we have this invasion, which has, in many ways, of course, kind of vindicated the more paranoid elements of the U.S. security state. I don't think rightly so. We were talking about this offline, Ema, but there's a kind of basic premise of anti-war activism in the U.S.
Yeah.
There has been for some time now, which is this idea of kind of mutual antagonism, that the forces of war within the West or the U.S. fuel forces of war in countries that are targeted by those forces of war, and that it's a feedback loop, and that conservative mm-hmm. or reactionary forces feed off of each other, whether it be Iran, Russia, U.S. And this is sort of a basic tenet or basic premise of anti-war activism. So instead of saying, like two kids in the back of a car saying, you know, he hit me first or he hit me first, we sort of unilaterally try to push back against that because that's the thing we have control over. Instead of doing the kind of classic imperial justification of, well, the British Empire is morally preferable to the Belgian Empire. And then the Belgian Empire says, well, we're morally preferable to the Arab slave traders. And then the Arab slave traders says, we're morally preferable to the sort of slave traders of Central Africa, et cetera, right? The kind of, there's always a worse empire, so we're justified in being an empire.
There's always an eviler evil.
There's always an eviler evil, right? And so we wanted to let the invasion play out a little bit before hot taking anything. And obviously the worst sin in the world is to have an opinion just to have it. But now that we're 3 weeks in and we've been kind of marinating on some of these bad takes, we thought we would do a recap of what we consider the listicles. Again, apologize, they're a little hacky, but we're not above them. We are a suspender slapping populist show at heart. And so we wanted to kind of recap what we thought were the five worst U.S. media responses, making a bad situation worse and taking away the absolute worst lessons from what happened to push long-standing and pre-existing ideological and political ends. And so the first one is one I wrote about for the Substack, which is the idea that this is somehow an affront on the liberal rules-based order. One of our favorite zombie phrases.
To the fainting couch, Adam.
The liberal rules-based order. So the invasion can't be bad because invading sovereign countries is bad per se, or it can't be bad because of its imperialist justification.
Right, which it is. Let's just be clear. invading other countries is bad. Military invasions from powerful armies targeting civilians, really bad things. So let that be said. Let that sit there.
But of course, the U.S. media can't just say invading countries is bad because it's a violation of the sovereignty of the country, because that would impugn, obviously, us and all our allies. So they have to come up with this high-minded concept that Putin attacked the liberal rules-based order.
That's right. That we were all just kind of going about our rules-based lives in a rules-based world. And then Putin happens and upends it, which is an affront not only to human life, but to our grand bargain of society, I think, is kind of this like high-minded concept that, you know, we all live in this yellow submarine of post-World War II rules, liberal rules-based order. So, for instance, right when Russia invaded, we have this in the Washington Post written by Fareed Zakaria, one of our all-time favorite rules-based writers, with this opinion piece, quote, "Putin's war reminds us why liberal democracy is worth defending." And it says this, quote, "Russia's utterly unprovoked, unjustifiable, immoral invasion of Ukraine would seem to mark the end of an era. One that began with the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. In that post-Cold War age, Western ideas about politics, economics, and culture spread across the world, largely uncontested, and American power undergirded the international system. It was not a period of tranquility, think of the wars in Yugoslavia and the Middle East, but it was a time in which American power and liberal democracy seemed triumphant, and the international system seemed to work more cooperatively than at any previous point in history," end quote.
So obviously none of that's true. The New York Times jumped on this same bandwagon March 4th, 2022. They did the thing where they let their straight reporters do analysis. They call it news analysis. So Damian Cave, who's ostensibly a Middle East reporter for the New York Times, he wrote one of these news analysis where he gets to kind of wax poetic about the tragedy to the liberal rules-based order.
It's allowed to be less quote-unquote objective than their straight news.
Yeah, which is a good window into how they really think, which is kind of these really boring Aspen Institute bromides. You wrote, quote, "Almost universally, from leaders in Europe to Asia to current and former American officials, Ukraine is being viewed as a test for the survival of a 75-year-old idea that liberal democracy, American military might, and free trade can create the conditions for peace and global prosperity. Because the founder of that concept, the United States, continues to struggle with partisanship, COVID, and failure in distant war zones, many foreign policy leaders already see Ukraine in dire terms as marking the official end of the American era and the start of a more contested multipolar moment." So there's this concept of liberal rules-based order. Tony Blinken uses it. Biden uses it. Pundits, Fareed Zakaria, all these sort of serious people use it. To be clear, it doesn't mean anything because, again, international law is what's relevant. But they can't say international law because the U.S. doesn't abide by international law.
Because the U.S. doesn't care about international law, right.
So the U.S. is not ratified and is therefore not subject to the majority of international treaties signed by the majority of countries, including the Discrimination Convention of 1958, the Convention Against Discrimination in Education in 1962, the Convention of the Minimum Age for Marriage and Registration of Marriages of 1962, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty of 1972, the Minimum Age Convention of 1973, the Moon Treaty of 1979, the Convention of the Rights of the Child of 1990, Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1996, the Kyoto Protocols of 1997, the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court of 1998, the Convention on Cluster Munitions of 2008, or the Arms Trade Treaty of 2013. Now, not only is the U.S. not a signatory to the International Criminal Court, the most prominent manifestation of this alleged rules-based order, it passed the American Services Members Protection Act of 2002, dubbed by Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International as, quote, "the Hague Invasion Act that literally compels the President of the United States to invade the Netherlands and free any American citizen from The Hague if they're held by the ICC for war crimes. The U.S.'s closest ally and the biggest recipient of military aid, Israel, is not subject to pretty much any major international agreement, including the Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1968, Missile Technology Control Regime of 1987, the Biological and Toxin Weapon Conventions of 1972, the International Criminal Court of 1998, the Convention of Cluster Munitions in 2008, or the Chemical Weapons Convention of 1997.
So what are the rules, right? So what are these rules? It really just means that United States, and somewhat tangentially its buddies, are in control and can do whatever they want whenever they want.
For example, fund and fuel and arm the completely illegal, unjustified, and arbitrary bombing of Yemen from Saudi Arabia that's killed 400,000 people. Obviously, the Israeli occupation of Palestine for going on 60-some-odd years, depending how you define it. They're not affronts to the liberal rules-based order.
Somehow, these things are not affronts to a quote-unquote rules-based order. And the reason you can tell this is such claptrap nonsense is because even by virtue of what is like nodded to as, you know, whether it's post-Cold War or post-World War II, usually there's a nod to the UN, that like the UN kind of has these rules, again, always skirting the issue and certainly the mention of the term international law because of the implications there. But there is usually this kind of like nudge, nudge, wink, wink to the UN, except of course, the UN is where the embargo on Cuba has been roundly rejected by virtually every single country on the planet year after year, except for the United States, Israel, and like Palau and Micronesia. And same for whenever there is a General Assembly resolution on something having to do with the occupation or ethnic cleansing or colonization of Palestine. Again and again, we see what the vast majority of the planet, or at least its representatives at the governmental level, and we can absolutely say that that doesn't actually account for the people of the planet, sure, but in that quote-unquote rules-based system, we see time and again the United States and its closest allies flaunting the very rules that it claims to uphold, because actually, it's not about those rules. It's about the rules that the United States sets for itself.
Right, which is like, again, there's always this high-minded, big ideas, Atlantic Council, head in the clouds, TED Talky, big picture. There's this kind of clash of the, well, really, it's a sort of clash of civilizations argument fundamentally, that there's this cheesy dichotomy of the civilized Western liberal democracy rules-based blah, 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 right? I'm going to vomit just saying it, versus this sort of authoritarian orient who is sort of clashing with us. And we represent this kind of more civilized, advanced economies marked by capitalism. And they're this sort of hodgepodge of authoritarian tendencies that are they're even sometimes pawned off as being kind of indigenous to the Slavic or Chinese brain. And that this is kind of what we're defending. And it's like, no, there was a protection racket from some, I'm in Chicago in the 1920s and I was being protected by one mafia family and now Al Capone came along and threw them out and there's another mafia. There's no sort of like principle at work here. To the extent to which there is, they're completely reverse engineered and they have these glaring inconsistencies that nobody really believes, but you have to sort of give this kind of moral arc because it gives it higher stakes. And of course, you can't just say the invasion's bad because then that would necessarily implicate you. So you have to come up with this more grandiose narrative that's really just kind of insulting to everyone's intelligence and really tedious and using this moment to kind of bolster this self-indulgent and self-aggrandizing narrative is, I think, pretty greasy stuff. This is not a time to chest beat.
Well, right, because it also nods to this like strange nostalgia for something that never was. Like, liberal rules-based order is basically the international imperial way of saying make America great again.
Or, yeah, I mean, how many millions of Vietnamese died in the post-war liberal rules-based order? How many Cambodians were carpet bombed? How many nuns were tortured and mutilated in Central America? How many people were subjugated to starvation from the, you know, World Trade Organization rule? I mean, we can go on and on. How much poverty was inflicted upon and how much wealth was extracted from the global south based on this liberal rules. I mean, it's claptrap.
How many weddings, funerals, and hospitals were, you know, schools and school buses and ambulances have been bombed by the United States and its allies under the very same rules-based order, liberal rules-based order that we're supposed to lament the, you know, attack on or the death of. So
yeah, it's CFR Aspen Institute circle jerking. And nobody outside of the DC New York corridor buys this bullshit.
So let's move on to our second in our list of worst media responses to Russia's Ukraine invasion. This is the selective glorification in the media of native resistance to invasion and occupation. And Adam, I've been struck by this one as soon as we started seeing all of these articles come out about not only noble Ukrainians defending their homes, rallying in town squares, committed to pushing back, defeating the invader and the occupier, but something seemed a little gratuitous about this in the face of who is not allowed to defend themselves.
Yeah, so Ayman Mohyeldin and Mehdi Hasan, and I think it was on their Peacock Network show, which is usually where they relegate the good stuff or the decent stuff.
That's where they're allowed to do that. Yeah, they can't do that on television.
They both had good segments on this, and we'll put that in the show notes. You should go watch that. It's kind of better than what we'll do here because they have higher production values. But basically, the double standard of violent resistance is patently obvious to anyone who's followed anything from Palestine to Yemen. Now, this isn't to say that we need to like lessen the sympathy or diminish the empathy for Ukraine, but it is clear to people who've had a very frustrating time getting people to care about, say, the 400,000 dead in Yemen over the last 7 years with U.S. sponsorship, backing, funding, fueling, and defense at the U.N., something obviously we've been screaming about in this show forever. It's a little bit frustrating to see that play out and see that the sort of insta-sympathy when a country both falls into the convenient bucket of a kind of pro-NATO narrative and is also blonde hair, blue eyes, and fulfills that kind of European pedigree. It's frustrating. And I know that a lot of people I've talked to offline and activists who've worked on Yemen and Palestine, they want to sort of tread carefully because you don't want to look like you're doing an oppression Olympics in that sense. Obviously, this is a more urgent and immediate topic of conversation, given that there's a fucking invasion. It is frustrating and is very stark when you see the double standard applied. Obviously, the story about the refugees is one example of that, but even tabling that, the glorification of violence, you had a BBC reporter tweeting out a picture of how to make a Molotov cocktail. Of course, can you even imagine a BBC reporter doing that for Palestinians resisting Israeli occupation? Can you even imagine them even doing that for Yemenis in terms of like launching rockets inside of Saudi Arabia to fight back against the indiscriminate bombing? I mean, we would never see these in other contexts. And so it is a little bit stark. It definitely shows that the sort of worthy and unworthy victim framework of Noam Chomsky is still very much clear.
Now, also, what it does is not only set up a hierarchy of victimhood or who is deserving of resistance or not, but also a lot of this coverage reinforces the justification for U.S. and NATO provided training and weapons shipments to Ukraine, and thereby inflating the already gigantic U.S. military budget. Now, again, supporting resistance against invasion is not in itself a bad thing. It's just that what we see here, the kind of triumphant media narratives of Ukrainian resistance, is just something that you would never see in other contexts. I mean, you have this from The Guardian from February 23rd. Ukrainians ready for resistance. And here's the quote: the whole country will be fighting back, with this subheadline: army less well equipped than Russia's, but can call upon 500,000 combat experienced veterans. A couple days later on NBC News, you had this article, February 25th. Russian offensive unexpectedly slowed by fierce Ukrainian resistance. Vox the next day, February 26th. Ukraine's resistance is built on the backs of volunteers. The same day from the BBC, Ukraine conflict, the women making Molotov cocktails to defend their city. The Guardian from February 28th. Quote, I haven't told my granny, end quote. Ukraine student Molotov cocktail makers, with the sub headline, civilian volunteers come forward in large numbers to help war effort against Russian invasion. Now, again, in any other context, you would not see this kind of civilian volunteer militia, you know, coming out in support of their own sovereignty, of their own communities, their own families, their own neighbors. It just is not seen elsewhere.
Yeah. I mean, this glorification of resistance from occupation doesn't fall within the fog of war, both sides. It's complex. There's a very clear moral distinction that is not offered to any other conflict, which again, I think is a point others have made better than us, but it's certainly worthy of note. The third bad media narrative is this uncritical glorification of American foreign fighters rushing to Ukraine as some kind of... In and of itself can be dicey, you know, whether or not we should be flooding foreign fighters into Ukraine is perhaps something we should stop and debate, especially given some of the ideological proclivities of the fighters, both in the U.S. and there. But it's done in this context of like, it's curing this Vietnam syndrome of American veterans and American troops, that America had kind of lost faith in its duty. And now there's this kind of good moral narrative. There's a kind of good war we can go fight to defend the people of Ukraine. So the New York Times, David Phillips, wrote this in this amazing racist paragraph. I'm going to read it to you. This is from a March 5th article. I can't stand by American veterans join the fight in Ukraine, which is more or less just a recruiting pamphlet for American veterans to go fly into Eastern Europe and go flood the fighting zone. It said, quote, "All across the United States, small groups of military veterans are gathering, planning, and getting passports in order. After years of serving in smoldering occupations, trying to spread democracy in places that had only a tepid interest in it, many are hungry for what they see as a righteous fight to defend freedom against an autocratic aggressor with a conventional and target-rich army." Okay, so where to start with that?
Ooh, there's a lot.
Number one, smoldering, e.g. hot. There's this vague desert.
It's so deserty.
Yeah, it's so deserty. Of course, Afghanistan, not a desert, but whatever.
But it's also simmering, right? Like slow burning.
Yeah. And they were trying to spread democracy. This, again, this is a straight reported article. And a journalist actually says, unironically, that the U.S. was trying to spread democracy. So some good ideology smuggling, which, again, I think if I polled about 1,000 American troops, I would say maybe 7 of them would say they were trying to spread. Not even they would argue they were trying to spread democracy. Most are fairly ironic and self-aware about what their goals were. And spreading democracy, sure, shit was one of them. Then we have this, then we have a great racist kicker card here. They rejected American occupation, not because they were a foreign occupation, but because they didn't like democracy. They had only a tepid interest in democracy. You know, it's not really in the Quran. It's not part of their primitive tribal ways. They don't really want democracy. You know, they're not quite there evolutionarily speaking. They're not that developed yet. So they had only a tepid interest in it. Then we have the real denouement here, which is many are hungry for this as a righteous fight against an autocratic aggressor with the conventional and target-rich army. So there's just these nice Russian 19-year-olds we get to go over there and just blow away because, we have to exorcise this Vietnam syndrome we have from Iraq and Afghanistan. And this is, by the way, the same shit you got when people talked about the Vietnam syndrome when the U.S. invaded Grenada in 1983 and then the Persian Gulf War in 91. You would see similar stories that we were going to exorcise our demons because we finally had a good war without all the moral ambiguity. So, again, this is a recruiting commercial in the New York Times, glossy front page story, the obligatory photo of the veteran looking out of a window, you know, kind of contemplating his Germany to go kill rich Russians and who feels a little bit of a sad because the Iraqis told him to fuck off and they didn't really want democracy because they're primitive.
Right, but now he can fight on behalf of democracy-loving peoples.
There's a simple yet good and bad narrative. Now, of course, any kind of examination about whether or not it's a good idea to take a bunch of like hothead American veterans with maybe dicey politics and send them over to a war zone is whether or not that's a good idea, whether or not that can lead to escalation, whether or not that can be radicalized certain fighters. Not really discussed, just kind of breezed past, and it's seen as this kind of righteous kill, which is pretty typical for the genre, and the kind of horniness and urgency with which the media is glorifying American foreign fighters and whitewashing some of the extremist ideology of some of the fighters, of course not all, but I think a non-trivial amount, is I think something that we'll be talking about in 5 years from now, that we'll come back and think maybe we should have been a little more critical or pumped the brakes or had some kind of filtering process in place.
Yeah, just this idea that, you know, love letters to mercenaries also maybe doesn't work the same in every context, right? I mean, when American fighters are mercenarying themselves, you always get different kinds of coverage. I actually remember an August 2012 article in the New York Times that Jody Ruderin wrote called Enlisting from Afar for the Love of Israel. And it was about Americans becoming citizens of Israel so that they could enlist in the army. And, you know, they were lovingly dubbed lone soldiers. And, you know, I remember this piece when it came out, you know, about having that they need to defend a Jewish future or that their motivation is often way higher than the average Israeli, right? Like they're going because they really care. They're really dedicated. And these kinds of articles, they seem a little dubious to me. I mean, you know, in Time magazine from March 7th, Meet the Foreign Volunteers Risking Their Lives to Defend Ukraine and Europe. How's that for framing? Bulwark of civilization, right, against foreign hordes. You know, and you see these again and again. But let's, Adam, move to our fourth worst trope, maybe my favorite of the list, the freedom friesification of U.S. sanctimony, or how I learned that you can no longer drink a Moscow mule on the Lower East Side.
Yeah, again, I think a lot of these responses, they stem from a place of empathy. Like people want to kind of show solidarity. And it's obviously very selective. It's very media-driven solidarity. It fits into a neat kind of moral compartmentalization. Some of the stuff has gone completely overboard. There's now a basic threshold, Metropolitan Opera, various artistic institutions, art houses, symphonies, where a Russian national has to not only denounce the war, they have to condemn Putin per se, or they get fired, which is an interesting standard.
That's a really high bar to hit, especially if people have family members in Russia.
Yeah, for a leader in Russia, and Putin, who, you know, routinely kills dissidents, or is alleged to, I'm pretty sure he does. This is a very high bar to meet. And it's certainly a bar, Nima, that will literally never be applied to an American, British, or Israeli national when their countries commit war crimes, which is pretty much on average every 5 minutes. So this is, again, one of these glaring double standards that you're like, okay, I know whataboutism is a devious Soviet mind trick, that we're not allowed to use that, because then that's a
pro- that's right.
Trust me, it's a propaganda tactic. The constant zombie brainless evocation of the term whataboutism is itself not a propaganda tactic. Trust me, the actual term itself is the thing itself is the propaganda. And I watched John Oliver once, so I know it's whataboutism. I listen on NPR, it's whataboutism. People intuitively want to have a kind of consistent moral principle or consistent ethical principle. I think it's part of human nature. You sort of want to have a coherent set of rules that can guide the universe and guide the world, so you have a sense of what's going on, right? And the standard that we are now applying to Russia for its invasion of Ukraine, if applied to, again, the half dozen other countries, whether it be Saudi Arabia, UAE, Israel, of course, the standard could never be satisfied by any. Now, the whole, like, we're going to pour out Russian liquor, we're going to make Russia, it's like, okay, like, I get it. We need to, like, again, this, it gets a little dicey because Russia is both a country and an ethnicity, and obviously nationality by definition. And it's like, so we're doing a kind of really shitty version of BDS that's more based on ethnicity than it is like the government's actions. Yeah. And then like randomly calling out high status Russians to have some position on it. Now, obviously they're not the primary victims here, but this is getting a little bit overcorrected, a little bit silly. And of course, this is just a standard that would never be met by any other conflict ever.
Yeah. I think there's just like the kind of glibness of it that, yeah, I mean, sure. Like to show solidarity, like, change the name of a Moscow mule to the Kyiv mule, sure. But like the implications there, especially when it gets to classical musicians are having their concerts canceled, not because they're, you know, standing up being representatives of the Russian government. You know what I mean? Like there's a line there that is also not necessarily even being demanded of by Ukrainians themselves that I think gets this kind of like, oh, we're so in solidarity with Ukraine that we're deciding what our own kind of BDS is going to be. But like the BDS just kind of shows up in like canceling concerts and like renaming drinks.
Yeah. There's a general liberal proclivity of do something ism, like the quote unquote do something, we have to do something. And it kind of doesn't matter what that something is. You just have to look like you're doing something. And in this case, again, because of the kind of neat national security, there's a subtext to a lot of this, which is a lot of liberals are exercising frustration over Russiagate and the belief, the widespread belief, fair or not fair, that Russia effectively elected Trump. And there was a lot of trauma associated with that. And this is kind of a way of channeling some of that anger for a lot of American liberals. Now, that's not the case, of course, for Ukrainians who could give a shit. But that's definitely one thing animating this and why it kind of took on this kind of extra oomph as opposed to other.
Yeah.
Again, I think there's the fact that it aligns with NATO's interests. There's the racial element, which can't be understated, but it also has a kind of revenge play for what is viewed as kind of Russians meddling in American democracy, and that we're going to kind of punch him in the nose and we're going to basically eliminate Russia from the globe.
Right. And that like, see, we knew all along, ever since 2016, we've known, and now it's about time. So that will take us to our fifth and final worst media trope that we've seen since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And this, Adam, you have also written about for the old sub, the idea that liberal concerns over fossil fuel and also military budgets mysteriously vanish in the face of the big bad Russian bear. The idea that now all of a sudden, even former enemies like Maduro's Venezuela are now back in the fold, because when we really need to stick it to Russia, we just cut off the oil supply. So we need to get our oil from somewhere else. So we have brand new friends who can supply us with oil, and that is going to stick it to Putin.
It's a Nixon China thing, and all the sort of hand-wringing about human rights just goes out the window because that was all bullshit, of course. Yeah, so there was a Republican talking point that emerged within hours of the invasion. In fact, it predates the invasion by a couple weeks, that Putin's invasion of Ukraine was brought about by American and European green energy and a weaning off of fossil fuels, and that because of dependence on fossil fuels from Russia vis-a-vis Europe and also U.S. not being able to, you know, supply, which is bullshit, but whatever, that the Green New Dealification or the greening of energy is what emboldened Putin, and that the only way we could really fight back against Putin is to start drilling on federal...
That narrative does a lot, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, it's pretty cynical stuff. I mean, again, this is... The American Petroleum Institute's been pushing this. Marco Rubio's been pushing this. God, Marco Rubio tweets about this 1,000 times a day of how we need to up energy production. We need to remove EPA regulations. We need to lift bans on sort of very limited bans on drilling for natural gas and fracking and shale gas on American federal lands.
And then any kind of Green New Dealing, which granted isn't even happening. But again, it's like the fucking defund argument. But like... that the Green New Deal, which, again, not policy, is making us weak in the face of world energy production, world energy politics.
And as gas prices soar, which is probably motivated, informed a lot by, I mean, gas prices are hard to pin down, but it's informed a lot by price gouging from oil companies. That is true. But it's also just general price fluctuation. And of course, Saudi Arabia has been somewhat recalcitrant despite our support for them, but I guess they're still pouty that the Blinken did a little bit of a wrist slap. That this is a perfect storm of liberal capitulation, which is, of course, what ended up happening. Democrats seeing the prices raise, looking at the midterm elections, and looking at the fact that they don't really give a shit about any meaningful transition to any green economy, really. They started boasting about how they were... going to increase production, have increased production. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki on Twitter said, quote, production is up, rising and approaching records. Yet Russia's actions still leave our consumers vulnerable. It's a reminder that the real energy security comes from reducing our dependence on fossil fuels. Okay, so some point in the future, we're going to do that. U.S. production of natural gas and oil is rising and approaching record levels. More natural gas than ever this year, more oil than ever next year. And even with global pandemic, more oil production in the last year than during the previous administration's first year. Okay, so wait a second. We need to convert over to green energy at some point in the future, but it's kind of inconvenient, so we'll do that in like 50 years. For now, we are breaking record level oil and we're bragging about it. And so obviously this is extremely bleak for climate activists.
It's like when Obama was like, hey, I did that.
So yeah, Sarah Lazar wrote about this for In These Times, friend of the show, wife of me, wrote an article in These Times called The Existential Danger of Using Ukraine Invasion to Ramp Up Fossil Fuel Production, where she basically documents, Kate Aronoff had a piece on this as well, that this is basically any kind of momentum towards reducing the small micro fraction footprint of even like federal lands, that's all out the window. Everyone's putting the stickers with the Biden saying, I did that to your price. I filled up my gas tank the other day and I said, let's go, Brandon. I did not say that, but I thought it. But of course, I'm not a drilling idiot who doesn't blame the president for gas prices. But this is now going to be set back any kind of green efforts. And this is, of course, a common... casualty of war, again, not top on the list, but you know, it is important, which is that the forces of extraction and oil are using this to push back against green energy, which is something that, you know, is an old talking point. I mean, Hillary Clinton in 2015 even said a lot of the anti-fracking protesters and Dakota Access Pipeline protesters were being echoed by and supported by Russian media, Russian disinformation campaigns. So this idea that those who want to weaken U.S. energy sector are kind of doing the bidding of Putin. This is an argument that Marco Rubio's explicitly made.
So you just ramp up production, and therefore that is somehow like an anti-Russian gambit, as opposed to an anti-planet gambit.
That's how you stick it to Putin. Yeah, because if you follow the new kind of logic of the Cold War snitch factory of if you have messaging alignment with the Kremlin, they love to talk about messaging alignment, syncs up with, right? So it's cool. That opposing American energy, it does sync up with the Kremlin line, right? Because by definition, if they're more reliant on Russian oil, they're less dependent on ours and vice versa. So if you take that logic, it is true. If you have this kind of zero-sum antagonistic Cold War logic that basically all these protesters who are trying to get rid of oil pipelines and shale gas and fracking and all these sort of things, that they're actually all sort of doing Putin's bidding by weakening the U.S. energy sector. And That's obviously a very bleak place to be if you're a climate activist who thought with the Biden administration you'd be making some progress, although I'm not sure how Pollyannish that may be. But that's certainly the state of play right now with the White House press secretary bragging about increased oil production. So it's like, okay, well, I guess at some point we'll get around to the whole transitioning to fossil fuels.
Yeah, and just like chest thumping about it, right? It's not even, oh, well, in this time of crisis, we're going to do this. But it is actually like, no. Look at how effective this is. And even with nods toward climate change, you can tell that there's a kind of glee in this kind of, see, we told you all you do-gooders out there, you're just actually doing Putin's bidding. And what we really need is for, more production.
The unspecified, no time frame. So at some point, 2080, we need to get around to fossil fuels. Having said that, right? So the Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Having said that,
but
ain't gonna happen now. So we're just gonna jack up oil production. It's like, okay, well, the IPCC says you have to stop extracting oil now, like literally now, for us to even curb catastrophic climate change in the next 10, 15 years, like now, collectively as a species.
You know, Adam, that just sounds like Russian propaganda, dude.
It sounds like Russian propaganda.
Well, that will do it for our top five, worst five media tropes since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for this Citations Needed news brief. We will be back very soon with another full-length episode of Citations Needed, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, you can follow the show on Twitter at CitationsPod, Facebook, Citations Needed, and please do, if you do not already, support us through Patreon, and you're able to. Please do consider supporting us through Patreon, and you can find us there at patreon.com/citationsneededpodcast. All your support through Patreon is so incredibly appreciated, as we are 100% listener funded.
Yes, thanks again, and thanks for listening, and if you can, please support us on Patreon. We're very grateful. Thank you.
So that will do it for the Citations Needed news brief. I am Nima Shirazi.
I'm Adam Johnson.
Citations Needed is produced by Florence Burrow Adams. Associate producer is Julianne Tweed. Production assistant is Trenda Lightburn. Newsletter by Marco Catalano. Transcriptions are by Morgan McCaslin. The music is by Granddaddy. Thanks again for listening, everyone. We'll catch you next time.